I was asked a question during, a couple of questions during the break, which I think would be worth just clarifying. So one was about the my fairly glib statement in passing that Marxism could be thought of as a religion. What exactly was I talking about there? That was under-elaborated. Here's, I think, the way to think about that overly glib claim. It's that some forms of Marxism, historically, functioned very much like religion. Some forms. Not that it's inherent in Marxism that it has a religious dimension, but that some forms of Marxism built up a set of ideas which then people came to believe, so they incorporated those ideas into their subjectivity, that really had a very religious feel to it. And the aspect of Marxism that had that character is sometimes referred to as teleological Marxism. That's the form of Marxism that says there's some grand purpose to history. The historic mission of the working class is the liberation of humanity. History has a direction and a destination. The destination is a glorious future in which all people will live in peace and harmony, etc. You know, and that kind of vision of a world of struggle and strife and difficulty now, but which is not all in vain, because there is a purpose to history which will end in human emancipation. That's pretty similar to a lot of religious visions of human history. You can compare it, and some people have, to Christianity. So the Christian version of that is that we live in a world of suffering. Some versions still invoke the fall of humanity from the Garden of Eden, etc. Individual salvation is possible through belief, and the belief is in a glorious emancipated possibility, either in the hereafter or in some notion of future redemption of humanity. Where the notion of salvation is very individualistic, especially in the contemporary visions of Christianity. The difference between the telos of Christianity and the telos of Marxism is that the emancipation is collective in Marxism, in this religiosity, this religious version of Marxist. So the way to describe that in terms of the language that I'm proposing is ideological practices instill beliefs in people. We can then diagnose the content of those beliefs through various additional kinds of tools. Scientific practices enable us to diagnose the content of beliefs in terms of their scientific validity. To what extent do we believe them as being true because the evidence and theoretical arguments give us reasons to believe they're true? So there's scientific methods as a way of assessing the content of beliefs. Another content that you can identify in beliefs is their religious content. And the religious content, you would ask, to what extent do these beliefs give people a deep sense of purpose in life, in which they locate their individual lives and pain and struggle within some grand purpose, which they come to hold by virtue of these beliefs? Well, Marxism then can be the beliefs that people hold, that we identify as beliefs that come from the Marxist tradition. These are beliefs that enable people to interpret the world. They are beliefs about how life is, and sometimes, but not always, we can evaluate those beliefs on scientific grounds. How much real evidence is there in support of these beliefs? Do we have a good grounding for them in terms of theoretical arguments and the like? So what hopefully we're doing in this class is interrogating the beliefs that constitute a Marxist, that constitute Marxism, interrogating those in terms of their scientific content. And then occasionally in history, these beliefs have also had this religious content. That would be another diagnosis of the content of the beliefs people hold. Okay. Let's go on with the vocabulary. Get Terborn's arguments nailed down. So the first, this is 2.1. First one we have to tackle is this idea of interpolation. But he gives this idea way more specificity than Althusser. And the way he talks about interpolation is in terms of a dual process of which he labels subjection and qualification. What does ideology do to people when it forms them as subjects? What it does to people is captured by these two words, subjection and qualification. Subjection implies forming the subjectivity of individuals in terms of some general model of subjectivity. I'll explain what this means in a second. Qualification implies the suitability of such subjectivity for specific roles, positions within relations in a society. Subjection refers to the effects of ideology on individual subjectivity. Qualification refers to the effects of such subjectivity on the individual's insertion into a society. So we have all been subjected quite effectively to the ideological processes of capitalism in ways that qualify us to function very well in a capitalist society. Most of the beliefs we hold make us well suited for this kind of society. You know, none of us, I imagine, finds it difficult to go shopping. I mean, you may find it difficult if you don't have the necessary funds, but you know what it means. All sorts of things which are really weird in this society we see as just ordinary and know how to navigate them. We can live with harsh and horrible forms of inequality without being in a constant state of aggravation. Because even if we also hold beliefs that go against this society, we know how to subjectively accommodate our lives to this society. If the analysis was purely functionalist in character, subjection and qualification was purely functionalist, there would always be a perfect correspondence between these two aspects of interpolation. That's what interpolation is. It subjects and qualifies you to function in a society. They would always work perfectly. It would be the requirements of qualification which would always dictate the forms of subjection. What Terborn insists is that the correspondence between these two things, how you're qualified to be in a society and what you're subjected to, that the correspondence is never guaranteed. The correspondence is the result of struggles, and that various forms of non-correspondence and contradiction between subjection and qualification not only can occur but are virtually inevitable, that there's at least some tension between these. This is going to be of big importance when we talk about the role of ideology in social change rather than simply in social reproduction. Okay, so that's the first vocabulary bit. Subjection and qualification. Subjection is an exploration of how particular cognitive understandings, beliefs are inculcated in you. You're subjected to those beliefs, you become a subject. And qualification refers to, given that you've got those beliefs, what roles can you now fill comfortably? Are you qualified to fill by virtue of those beliefs? Modes of interpolation. This subjection qualification of individuals in Terborn's analysis involves three different forms of interpolation or modes of interpolation. Again, this weird word, interpolation. Here's how to think about it. Ideologies Terborn writes, subject and qualify subjects by telling them answers or giving them answers to three kinds of questions. Basically, what ideologies do as they subject you and qualify you to function in the world is it answers three questions. What exists, what is good, and what is possible. The answers to these questions are beliefs. What exists tells you about all the types of things in the world and how they're interconnected. What exists includes your theories about how the world works. So it's a whole set of beliefs you have of how the society, of what the society is like and how it works. What is good tells you, answers the question, what's desirable and undesirable, and what is possible is the answer. The answer to that question tells you what kinds of alternatives might there be. This set of beliefs, if they are well designed for an existing social order, can be thought of as successive lines of defense of a given social order. The investigation of an ideology revolves around how the subjective recognition of each of these is formed and transformed. What's the actual content of the answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible? The what exists part we'll be discussing on Thursday. That's the problem of mystification. So the discussions of commodity fetishism, for example, fall under the heading what exists. It's a way of talking about how people come to understand what exists in the world and how it works. What is good is the central problem of legitimation. How people come to hold beliefs about the desirability of what they observe as existing. And I like to think of what is possible as being the central problem of hegemony. What kinds of alternatives people come to realize. Now, in Terborn's analysis, there is an ambiguity which I've tried to disambiguate in my distinction between ideology and culture. I don't think Terborn makes that distinction systematically. Under the rubric, what is good, for example, two sorts of subjectivities are included: the cognitive belief in what is good and the motivational orientation of what is good. It's not entirely clear in Terborn whether the bourgeois value of competitiveness, whether he is treating this mainly as a value that people hold as a belief or as a personality trait that people hold as a disposition. So to say that you are subjected to the answer to the question, what is good, competitiveness is good, it's a good thing, that's part of your subjectivity, is the belief in the goodness of competitiveness. And this qualifies you to work in the labor market of capitalism. It's one of the things that makes you able to fill these roles, is the belief in competitiveness. Sometimes it seems that Terborn really means that what qualifies you is actually being able to be competitive, not just the belief in the desirability of competitiveness. But the actual ability to compete, having that disposition, I'm saying that's not a belief, that's a disposition, and that's what I'm calling the result of bourgeois culture, not bourgeois ideology. And I think Terborn doesn't so clearly distinguish these purely cognitive aspects from the motivational aspects. So in my view, the question of subjection and qualification applies to both. You're subjected to a set of beliefs and to a set of dispositions, which qualify you to function in the world, both because you feel comfortable at it, that's the dispositions, and because you believe in it, that's the cognitive aspect. Terborn's concept of habitus is almost entirely on the dispositional side. I mean, indeed it is. That's what it's about. It's about these underlying dispositions, not about beliefs. Bourdieu's Terborn's emphasis is more on the cognitive side. I think you need both, and I think it's a key problem how they're connected. A really fantastic book, which for those of you who are going to be card-carrying sociologists or kindred spirits, I would recommend you read, is by a British sociologist named Andrew Sayre. It's called The Moral Significance of Class. And it's one way of interpreting the book is it's precisely about that intersection. It's about the relationship between the beliefs that people have in their dispositions. And his analysis, what he focuses on in that book, is what he refers to as the internal dialogues people have with their own dispositions. You know, there's people reflecting upon who they are, and that reflection either reinforcing or undermining. You know, people interrogate themselves in internal moral dialogues. It's really an interesting exploration of that issue. Andrew Sayre, The Moral Significance of Class. What exists, what is good, and what is possible? Well, a lot of what we'll be talking about in the next couple of lectures is exactly what the content of those, what exists, what is good, and what is possible, what the content of those interpolations, those forms of subjection and qualification are, focusing on the cognitive aspects, because again, that's, I think, the heart of what the ideological discussion is about. The next point. The material matrix of ideology. This involves the distinction between the discursive and non-discursive practices and what Terborn refers to as sanctions and affirmations. Now we're getting down to mechanisms, how subjection and qualification actually takes place. People become social subjects not simply because they've been exposed to pronouncements of words that embody these beliefs. So it's not just that you hear competition is good. Competition is good. Men should be aggressive. It's not that those words just get drummed into you. The formation and transformation of subjectivities is the result of a systematic process of affirmations and sanctions. So you hear the words, that's the discursive aspect, but the words are brought home and become solidified in your subjectivity, not just from repetition, but because how they interface with what Terborn is calling affirmations and sanctions. Affirmations are can be thought of as the following. In affirming practices, now I'll quote a less beautiful sentence from Terborn, if an interpolated subject, you can just say if a subject, acts in accordance with the dictates of the ideological discourse, then the outcomes predicted by the ideology occur. So if you act according to the answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible, that you believe, that have been inculcated, if you act according to those beliefs, then the predictions embodied in that discourse occur. That's an affirming sanction, an affirming practice. A sanctioning practice constitutes the punishments invoked for contravention of the dictates of an ideological discourse. When you violate the dictates of that set of beliefs, then some sanction occurs. The distinction between discursive and non-discursive practices is, I think, not so obscure. As Terborn says, there is some difference between being pronounced dead by a hostile critic and being assassinated. A non-discursive practices are all the things that happen to you in practice when you either act in accordance with a set of beliefs or violate them. So losing a job, being unsuccessful in a competition would be non-discursive. being praised and criticized would be discursive affirmations and sanctions. The point, let me just finish this. The point is that ideologies are affirmed and sanctioned not just by words, but by these non-discursive practices which back up and reinforce or undermine the discursive practices. Terborn has a nice discussion of excommunication as a form of sanction. So excommunication is a form of sanction for people who deviate from the beliefs of an ideology. It's both a discursive sanction, you are pronounced outside the faith, but it also involves all sorts of non-discursive sanctions. You're being denied various access to various kinds of resources. You're shunned or burnt at the stake. I mean, being burnt at the stake is a non-discursive sanction for rather than just a pronouncement. One crucial consequence of this is going beyond the simple force-consent dichotomy as the basis of a ruling class domination. All force presupposes consent, at least in the sense of forms of subjectivity which make the application of force effective. And all forms of ideological interpolation, that is, the formation of subjects, presuppose a system of sanctions and affirmations which include elements of coercion. So it's not consent versus coercion, it's the interconnection and articulation between consent and coercion as aspects of the way in which beliefs are both inculcated and sustained through affirmations and sanctions. Yeah?
I think you may have begun to or possibly totally answer the question I was about to ask. I just want to make sure that I'm on point here with the distinction. So it seems to me that these are that sanction, the discursive and non-discursive sanction, that discursive sanction is a prerequisite for non-discursive. So for example, I'll just do a Japanese one because it's easy for me. If one decides that because you don't, a certain group of people do not agree with X, Y, and Z beliefs, that they are therefore disposable and can be rendered functional slaves to, I don't know, imperial expansion. They can be laborers, I don't care if they live or die, I'm going to work them to death, and they go away. That working them to death, to the point where they die and are literally worked to death, is the form, is the non-discursive sanction. But it is only possible insofar as they've already been discursively removed and sanctioned. Is one necessarily a prerequisite for the other, or can you be sanctioned non-discursively without being discursively sanctioned first?
So in the case of Japanese imperialism, the importance of the words was to convince the soldiers. Discursive aspect was just to reinforce the beliefs about what exists, what is good, and what is possible for the soldiers who were guarding these slaves.
Complementary process, which was the business owners that were, who were functionally, you know, I guess, representatives of state policy, right, where they were gaining profits from working people to death. They were not military officials, right? There is an ideological justification that these are non-humans who have been removed from,
right,
who have been basically rendered commodities, right? Literally,
right. So the business owner in Japan or Germany who benefits from slave labor, might have had trepidations about benefiting from these practices, mm-hmm, unless there were a set of categories, a set of beliefs that would sanitize. Given that human beings are moral creatures and that we have compassion and empathy for other people. So something had to be done in order to make these business leaders feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
That's again, though, a set of discursive practices for the elite. They're the people whose ideology matters, not the victims, for whom no discursive practices were used at all.
Right, so I guess maybe if my example isn't.
There's no attempt to form the slave labor as social subjects.
Right, so that, I mean, maybe my example's not good, but then I guess the generic question still stands, is discursive sanction a necessary prerequisite for
no
tangible non-discursive?
No, because we have, so discursive and non-discursive sanctions are meant to explain why people hold the beliefs they do.
Right.
So you can hold beliefs because of the directly because you just figured out that, you know, this is when I do this, I if you go to a country where you don't speak the language, mm-hmm. and you don't know the practices that are considered mm-hmm. desirable and undesirable, and you violate certain practices and you get nasty stares from people, you might yourself say, aha, I have violated a belief about what's the right way to behave, I'm going to change my belief without ever having been told. Mm-hmm. So you may be able to figure out, without any discursive mm-hmm. content being told you, what the, you know, what the belief is. So, I mean, a simple kind of example is jaywalking norms, right? So in some places, people will give you really nasty looks if you cross against the light. In other places, they don't. So the nasty look is a non-discursive sanction. It's a shunning, a form of shunning. But generally speaking, beliefs are put into words, and then they're backed by consequences. So the usual way of thinking about how you come to hold your beliefs about what exists, what is good, and what is possible, is that you are told them. But if they're not backed by consequences of a non-discursive character, then many of those beliefs won't have any bite to them. Now, particularly beliefs that bear on the proper way to behave within social contexts. So the enforcement of norms, of beliefs about how you should behave, that enforcement is filled with all sorts of subtle and sometimes not subtle forms of sanction as well as affirmation. So I guess in general, whenever you're talking about ideology, you have to, one of the lessons of this way of thinking about it is you have to be very clear as to whose ideology you're trying to explain, whose sets of beliefs. In some systems of domination, the key problem is to inculcate a set of beliefs in ruling groups. That's what's problematic, not inculcating beliefs in the subordinate population. One of the distinctive things about capitalism is that a key problem is instilling beliefs in the subordinate population, not just elites. So in slavery, the key problem is how do you make slave owners in a liberal society where they believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how do you make them comfortable with being slaves? That is a problem. It's a very difficult issue. It's a very elaborate apparatus of ideological inculcation of a discursive character was needed. And then that was backed by all sorts of affirmations and sanctions. In order to create a stable ruling elite set of ideologies, and then to spread that down the social hierarchy to the large number of non-elite whites that needed to share that ideology in order for the slave system to be stable. So it's was not a simple problem. And what we call racism, of course, was a pivotal component of it, but lots of other elements had to be in place as well. Okay, that's the material matrix of ideology: discursive and non-discursive practices, sanctions and affirmations. Now let's look at how all of this plays out in the general idea of contradictions and transformations of ideology. So it's a point of departure for this is the belief that we are indeed conscious, reflective initiators of action. So beliefs matter. It's a premise of Terborn's analysis that the beliefs people hold do matter. We are not the kind of creatures that live in the world simply by inertia or by the coercive elements of our environment, which mean that we really don't have any choices. nor entirely by our underlying unconscious drives and habits. So he's saying our beliefs do matter. Then the question is, if beliefs matter, one view is they matter because they continually and always reinforce all these other forces. Another is that, no, beliefs matter and they are also a point of intervention for transformation. And to get at that, we have to think through the nature of the contradictions that can get embodied in ideologies. This leads to what is a really interesting idea in his, which is basically an intergenerational perspective on the transformation of ideologies. The transformation of ideologies always presuppose an existing ideology. People are transformed from one kind of subject to another, not from being non-subjects into subjects. So whenever you observe a process of rapid ideological change, people's beliefs are changing, the way to think about it is that every new belief constitutes a transformation of something. People already had beliefs, and then their subjectivity is transformed, as opposed to they didn't have beliefs and they simply acquire new beliefs. We have to understand how this transformation of subjectivity occurs, rather than simply how people come to believe what they believe. We have to understand how beliefs are transformed. This may be just belaboring a point. The question, how do people come to believe what they believe, is always also the question, how do the beliefs they have come to be transformed? And that's true even when you're talking about early childhood. Kids form beliefs which then get transformed. So in my little example of shopping, their first belief was that everything on a shelf is something I can take. That belief gets transformed by either a parent saying, no, 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 put that back on the shelf, or a shopkeeper yelling at them. Different forms of transformation. So they then learn that what they thought was a simpler classification of things in the world, things on shelves I can take, becomes a more complex classification of things in the world. Some things on shelves I can take, some things I can't. That's a change in your belief about what exists and how the world works. And it gets infused with moral content. You don't steal things, etc. The learning of beliefs is always a transformation of beliefs. We then want to understand change, and here's the basic intergenerational perspective, as Terborn elaborates it. A parental generation will always mold its children according to its own form of subjectivity. And if ecological, demographic, socioeconomic relations remain the same, the younger generation will face exactly the same affirmations and sanctions of the existing ideologies as the parental one. So if nothing changes in the environment, the younger generation will face the same pattern of affirmations and sanctions as the parental generation, and the parental generation will discursively mold its children in the same forms of subjection. It follows that the explanation of the generation of ideologies will have to start from processes of change in the structure of a given society. It is these changes which constitute the material determination of the rise of ideologies. Changes in the social structure change the affirmations and sanctions which create openings for changes in ideologies. Contrast this to the idealist view, which assumes, quote, that just through the power of ideological imagination, each new generation of humans can emancipate themselves from ideological formation of their parents, even though facing exactly the same situations as the latter. So what Terborn is saying is that self-emancipation through sheer leaps of imagination is not possible, except in circumstances where there has been a change in the ecology of sanctions and affirmations which people face. The key idea here is that changes in social structures have two general consequences. And these consequences are what creates the openings for possible transformation. One is a change in the forms of sanctions and affirmations. That can change as economic conditions change, as contact with different societies occur. The emergence of capitalism means that capitalist subjectivity begins to be affirmed and rewarded, while feudal affirmations and sanctions are weakened. That's what the emergence of capitalism means, is that suddenly you get rewards for things that you previously did not. Stagnation in developed capitalism means that certain subjectivities cease to be affirmed in ways they once were. In post-industrial advanced stagnant capitalism, the relational material affirmations and sanctions around the work ethic have weakened. So the work ethic is a way of talking about the answer to the question, what is good? It's also part of the answer to the question, what exists? Work exists, and if you work hard, these consequences will follow, and this is a good thing. So there's a whole set of subjective beliefs that are bound up with what we call the work ethic. In certain periods of capitalism, the rewards and sanctions that people faced if they lived by that set of beliefs coincided with the beliefs, and in other contexts, it's weakened. So that's the first thing, is that there's changes in the forms and effectivity of sanctions and affirmations. And the second thing is that there can be a disjunction between subjection and qualification. People will exist in the process of social change, people will exist that have been subjected to one set of ideological interpolations. They've been subjected to one set of answers to the question, what exists, what is good, and what is possible, which no longer adequately qualify them to live effectively in the world, to make sense of who they are. This generates a kind of cognitive disruption which makes people open to new ideologies. That's often what is argued happened around gender in the course of the 50s and into the 60s. That there was an undermining of the affirmations and sanctions that had been embodied in traditional gender relations, which meant that there was increasingly a disjunction between the subjection, the forms of subjection that people and especially women had been socialized to, and the roles which they were expected to fill, and that created tensions, which then was the raw material for the eruption of new ideological possibilities. This then leads to, I think, an interesting account of the nature of contradictions and the temporality of change that in which these contradictions play out. Structural change in modes of production then change these material affirmations and sanctions so that the subjectivities people have no longer fit so well with the qualifications that are required. What then can be the case is that class struggles over affirmations and sanctions can set up competing systems of subjection and qualifications. There can be competing rather than a simple uniform system of affirmations and sanctions. Unions impose sanctions on certain kinds of competitiveness among workers, thus counteracting the affirmations of the market. And this generates clashing subjectivities based on clashing affirmations and sanctions. Demands of solidarity, for example, the sanctions against scabs, are a way that unions enforce sanctions and affirmations on the practices of people that would be encouraged by the market. Being a scab is encouraged by the market. Being a scab means you're taking advantage of a competitive opportunity. That's what capitalist markets encourage people to do, you know. So being a scab is a positive response to the affirmations and sanctions of the market, What unions try to do through their collective organization is to create counter affirmations and sanctions and make it costly for people to obey the affirmations and sanctions of the market. Conscious, motivated practice can establish the material framework for the transformation of subjectivities by either producing contradictions or intensifying them. This results in social subjects that have within them warring, incompatible forms of subjectivity, different answers to the question what exists, what is good, and what is possible, not just one set of answers. The different multiple subjectivities may not be congruent with each other. Now, this has a certain kind of postmodernist feel, that there, we are multiple selves, we don't have stable identities. I think that there is a truth to that, that our identities are not integrated into functional wholes, that there are multiple identities which people hold and which depend upon how they interface with different affirmations and sanctions. The forms of subjectivity of women within bourgeois patriarchal sex gender interpolations are not congruent with the form of interpolation of women as graduate students within academic institutions. The former demands passivity, gentleness. The latter demands assertiveness, aggressiveness, competitiveness. Such contradictions can motivate all sorts of responses. You know, this can result in struggles to change the affirmations and sanctions in academic relations. It can lead to a rejection of female subjectivity in the sex gender system or struggles to transform male subjectivity within academic relations. All these struggles are basically struggles around the affirmations and sanctions corresponding to particular forms of subjectivity, both at the level of beliefs, but also at the level of dispositions. This creates a really interesting and difficult question about the nature of the temporality of change. The speed of social change, the rate of change becomes important in this context. If change is very slow over many generations, then small, incremental, smooth adjustments are possible. If change is much more rapid, many dramatic changes within a single generation, then subjective reconstitution can become very problematic. So the time scale of the demands for changing beliefs relative to the life cycle can be hugely important. There is a what I think is one of the absolutely most brilliant pieces of cultural sociology. It's called The Fabrication of Labor by Richard Bernanke. And it's a comparison of Germany and Britain based on how many generations pass between the demise of feudalism and the rise of capitalism. And the central argument is that in Britain there is basically five generations between the demise of feudalism as a coherent cultural, ideological, social system and the rise of capitalism as a consolidated system, which allowed for a very slow process of cultural change, so that by the time capitalism arises, feudal culture is completely gone, and people are fully accommodated to what it means to be in a market, what it means to be an individual. I mean, all these properties which we take for granted had already developed in Britain by the time capitalism really takes off. Whereas in Germany, they overlapped, that capitalism and feudalism don't have a clean break, and that many feudal practices in terms of how labor thought of its activities continued in early capitalism, and it created a very different cultural context. It's a fantastic book under one of these great books that hasn't become part of the canon. It was early 80s book, mid 80s book, but which if any of you are interested in cultural, the sort of cultural political economy interface, I think it's as good as you can get. Finally, last point. Can new ideas and ideological struggles change people's minds? What does this mean? You know, often in sociological discussions of the roles of ideology, a central problem which people explore is the extent to which ideological appeals and campaigns can really change people's minds. And what does it mean to talk about this? The issue here is not so much the question, do ideas matter? But rather the question, can ideas change ideas? So here's how I think we should think about this. It's always possible for any given individual that simply thinking about problems, hearing novel ideas, chewing them over, and engaging in internal dialogues, to use Andrew Sayer's expression, it's always possible for any given person that this can result in changes of beliefs. People can individually change their beliefs by some combination of internal reflection, exposure to new ideas, thinking really hard about things, and so on. But that's not the question, whether for an individual this can happen. The question is whether exposure to ideas and introspection can explain the widespread change of ideas, the diffusion of ideas, the adoption of whole new clusters of ideas. And here's where Terborne's model has its power. What Terborne is asking is, what are the conditions which make it more or less likely that ideological changes will generalize and become a social force? Not simply that any given individual might adopt some new ideas and come to believe new things, but what are the conditions under which these are likely to become a social force? There were theologians arguing the sorts of things Luther argued for generations. In 1517, Luther puts his 95 theses on the, nails it to the door, and suddenly this becomes the spark, the key event that sets in motion the Protestant Reformation. There were people saying those sorts of things 100 years before, in the 16th century, even in the 15th century. But they didn't have the consequences they had. They did not become the basis of a massive reformation of the religious beliefs of the time and in its wake of the broader social ideologies that people held. Why did these ideas catch on and become a powerful social force in the early 16th century and not the 15th century? Well, Terborne would say, to answer that question, you have to look at the way in which the affirmations and sanctions that had been built around the medieval belief structure and religious structure had been eroding and creating spaces where there was an accumulation, a sort of surplus set of experiences people having that were no longer corresponding to the beliefs they held, and why the announcement of certain new ideas could suddenly help people make sense of things, which they were primed to want. That if things had been stable ideologically and culturally, I mean, Terborne doesn't, again, so much emphasize the cultural face of this, the dispositional face, the way it had been 150 years ago, then the theses nailed onto the door would not have had the consequences they had. That's a way, then, of thinking both about the importance of those ideas. The consequences did require new ideas being placed into the arena and part of the public discussion, but of the conditions which make it have that kind of resonance and people changing as a result. Yeah.
I know we're low on time, so I'll try to make this short and sweet. Since modes of communication are now accelerating exponentially at this point, and it seems like large social shifts are happening faster and more frequently, ought we expect that to continue? So, for example, your example took a couple hundred years, but the acceptance of homosexuals as a normal, family organization politically, for example, has taken less than six, right? States are just one after another now legalizing gay marriage. Ought we expect that this will continue and that it's now very easy to break down systems of ideology very quickly, and that this sort of temporality is accelerating and we're going to have to deal with it?
The fact that this has occurred very rapidly was the result of a series of changes that had occurred over a longer period of the last 30
years. Sure, but that's still less than the 200.
Yeah. So there's both there's a question of the how rapidly new ideas get disseminated, but whether that rapid dissemination still requires a change in the underlying structure of affirmations and sanctions, which meant that people listened to it.
Yeah.
So I still think you need this. You still, the basic structure of Terborn's argument, I think, remains valid. New ideas are not going to transform things unless they are capturing this surplus of disjuncture between between the beliefs people have and the practices.
Right. No, I'm not contesting that. My question is, ought we expect that these that transformations continue to accelerate because communication is now more in-person possible? Right? It's easy to present new ideas and ways of thinking to more people faster, which is one of the ways that we quicker.
So to the extent that the speed of change was a function of the speed of communication as opposed to the pervasiveness of the underlying structural conditions, then that would be true.
Okay.